songs in a sermon. Of course, she tells us what to eat and what to wear and when to send out a wedding invitation. Of course, she tells us such things. But beneath them, what she's really talking about is justice and love. She thinks that a society develops conventions about eating and dressing and smoking so that people don't run the risk of disgusting each other over something trivial. It's unloving to do that. Occasionally, Miss Manners gets very basic. For instance, she says that every couple needs a certain social device that may be called the look, capital T, capital L. It's a facial expression, something you do with your eyes and mouth that is unmistakable to your partner, but indecipherable to others. When you adopt the look in a social setting, what you are saying to your partner is, "Watch out. Something here is very, very wrong." Like what? Watch out. The man you are complaining about is the brother-in-law of the woman to whom you are complaining about him. Or watch out. The man you are telling that story to is the man who first told it to you. Or watch out. The reason nobody is following what you are saying, dear, is that you have food on your chin. The look isn't mere politeness, you understand. It's a survival tool, and it's therefore an act of love. Good manners are mostly good morals. Why bring a gift or write a thank you note? Why pick up after yourself? Why crack your gum or your knuckles only in wilderness areas? Why should off-key singers not contend for solo parts? Well, the reason is, of course, that we are to be thoughtful of others. One hookup between good manners and good morals is that the good people who have these things are thoughtful in both senses of the word. That is, they are reflective about others, and then they are considerate of them. Often they are kind, considerate, because they are reflective. They think about other people and how to treat them well, and then they treat them that way. For example, when they leave their telephone number in your voicemail, they leave it slowly enough so that you can write it down. When they enter a self-service gas station, and face it, outside New Jersey, they're all self-service now, they pull forward to the last pump so that nobody else has to drive around them and back in. Having good manners is all about being thoughtful. Thoughtful people fit themselves into society in such a way that everybody else has a chance to fit in there too. They make room for others and then help them flourish in the room they have made. In a word, they are hospitable. Now, most people's default impression of hospitality is that it is a domestic virtue of relatively low profile, but as a matter of fact, it shows up in Scripture a lot. One of the spiritual gifts, it's in the pastoral epistles, you know, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, it's often mentioned, Paul mentions it a lot. It turns out that in Scripture, hospitality is a fairly big deal. And in a few moments, I'll say a little bit more about that. So let's say that hospitality is the virtue that wants to make room for others and then help them flourish in the room that you have made. You make room for others and then you receive them there. In this setup, others are outsiders, relatively speaking, and you are an insider. You are a host and they are guests. If your guest is a stranger, you want the estrangement to be over. If your guest is an alien, your virtue is that of making this person much less of an alien. It's worth noticing that people to whom we are hospitable might never become close friends. They're somewhere in between being strangers and close friends. Hospitality occupies that large middle ground between estrangement and friendship. And I suppose we all think of it first in domestic terms, naturally. We have all remembered times when good people hosted us in their homes, prepared a meal for us, or they made up a room for us. They cleared a space. Hospitable persons reduce strangeness, alienation, by offering others welcome. Of course, the strangeness might be great or small. There's a spectrum here. If you travel in other cultures, you might get welcomed into a culture that is very different from your own, and the initial strangeness might be quite great. In fact, it might be great enough that if you are a business person or a speaker or a diplomat, you have to study another culture in order to fit into it. It's just a matter of being considerate. A guest of the Bedouin people, for example, must never refuse a dish of food that has been set before him or her, because why else would you refuse a dish of food unless you thought they were trying to poison you? Domestic hospitality is what we think of first, and naturally enough, I once read an article in the UNESCO Courier that says that for most of human history, I had never thought of this, but for most of human history, travelers have depended on the food and drink and shelter of others. No hotels, no motels, no restaurants. You travel and you have to appeal to strangers for food and drink and shelter. You couldn't travel any distance without it, and in hard climates, it often meant the difference between life and death. The Courier tells of one culture after another whose rituals of hospitality go back for centuries. For instance, to this day, the remnants of the Bedouin people out in the Arab deserts keep their campfire going all night so that strangers will spot it and be drawn to it. A really generous host will even ignite a second campfire on a hill right nearby so that people can't miss it. When a visitor arrives in traditional Bedouin culture, the host doesn't offend the visitor by prying into the reason for his travels. He doesn't even ask how long his guest means to stay. What the host does is to offer a place by the fire and probably a mat and, in any case, food and drink. Always food and drink. Handing food to a guest is actually momentous. It binds you to that person. The reason is that what you are saying when you pass a dish of food to someone is that you want that person to live or even to thrive. Handing food to a guest is a sacramental act. And I'd like to pause at this point in my talk and thank Larry Snyder for handing me a jar of his pickled asparagus, which my wife and I will enjoy as an hors d'oeuvre this very night. The Bible talks about food all the time. There's food all over the place in the Bible. Fruit trees in paradise, a Passover meal at Exodus time, manna in the desert, gleaning laws in farmers' fields, which, by the way, are some of the most gracious provisions that you could imagine. In Leviticus 19, God instructs the people of Israel to leave the ends of the rows for strangers and sojourners, not only to feed them, but also to protect their dignity. They don't have to ask. They don't have to beg. They don't have to search. All they have to do is follow the harvest right along, knowing that what is left at the ends of the rows is intended for them. Jesus multiplies loaves and fishes. Jesus eats breakfast on the beach with his disciples. The parables are fragrant with cookery and with the promise of banquets to come. And at the center of this, the communion for which Christians give thanks is plainly a ritual of hospitality. Jesus Christ receives believers at a table, and in the most sublime of mysteries, one so sublime and metaphysically so bizarre that we should never get comfortable with it, in the most sublime of mysteries, the host becomes the meal. and Christians end up eating and drinking their God. The point is that for such travelers as we are, this may mean the difference between life and death. But in speaking of sublime mysteries of this kind around hospitality, I'm getting ahead of myself, so let's go back to Hospitality 101 and start with the little things. You know, the old rule of character, as old as the Greek philosophers, do some little deeds and get a practice going. Start a practice and develop a habit. Gain some habits and build your character. Form your character and find your destiny right along with it. In the most vivid portrait in Scripture of final judgment, namely the parable of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, have you ever noticed what Jesus points to first? What's the standard for dividing the sheep from the goats? How do you tell whether somebody is right now fit for heaven? You look for hospitality. I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. The readiness to welcome a stranger, who would have ever thought that a person's destiny could be found right along this line? Hospitality, turns out, is a lot bigger than we had thought. But before we get anywhere near our destiny, we're still in our ABCs. Hospitality gets built and expressed by small acts of kindness. Miss Manners gave me 5 of the following 10, and then I added 5 of my own. So here's a list of 10 small acts of hospitality. When you bring fresh news to a hospitable person, he doesn't try to top it with bigger news of his own. In the aisle of a supermarket, hospitable people basically keep to the right with their carts and then park them up against the side if they have to go and leave them, instead of right in the middle of the aisle. If a person does abandon his supermarket cart in the middle of the aisle, your calling is to drop something into it that is expensive and vaguely embarrassing that you picked up for this purpose elsewhere in the supermarket. I'm thinking, for example, of a pack of condoms. Third, when they are out driving, hospitable people do not punish pokey drivers by tailgating them. In addition, hospitable people quite often wave other cars in from driveways on the side, and they do this especially if those driveways belong to churches. Fourth, when hospitable people drink the last cup of coffee in a common coffee pot, they make some more. Fifth, in conversations, hospitable people do not interrupt. They let others finish their sentences. They give other people a little space, a little silence to speak in. Remember that silence is the natural context in which we speak and the natural context from which we listen. Everybody notices that in Genesis 1, God speaks 6 times in 6 days, but then all those days have evenings. And God doesn't speak then. God doesn't talk all the time. Silence is the natural context from which even God speaks. Not bad to reflect on. Monks do a lot with silence and a lot with hospitality. It may be that they are linked. On airplanes, hospitable people leave room in the overhead storage compartments for other people's carry-ons. Seventh, in conversations, hospitable people do not make rhetorical comments that paint other people into corners. For example, they rarely say such things as, "You're probably getting bored with me right now," or, "You're just saying that to be nice," or, "I bet you sometimes wish you had married somebody else." People who say these things provoke lots of fake protests because they give other people no room to move. Eighth, in church, hospitable people make room not only for people with disabilities, but also for seekers. There are limits on this form of hospitality, as there are on all of them, but the habit of welcoming seekers in church is the habit of reducing unnecessary distance between the gospel and the seeker. That idea is as good as gold and as old as the gospel itself. And all of us who are ministers remind ourselves almost daily that seekers show up in our sanctuaries and in our own church family and in our own personal families and sometimes in our own hearts. Seekers are not rare birds. They are all of us. Ninth, hospitable people leave room for the mistakes of others. They don't try to fix everything. Of course, in a professional setting, and certainly in a professional academic setting, which is the one I'm most used to, a certain amount of vigorous fixing is just what the tuition pays for. Getting corrected is a way of getting educated, but even then, a whole lot depends on how you do it. Skillful teachers, hospitable teachers, as we all know who have had them, hospitable teachers manage to correct and encourage you at the same time. They will sometimes take a confused question and make something terrific out of it. Even if you are corrected in a hospitable classroom, you will know that you are in good hands. Basic classroom hospitality makes room for mistakes. The reason is that then students can ask questions without worrying that they're going to get crunched. They're willing to reveal their ignorance. They're willing to risk themselves a little. They would rather reveal their ignorance by asking a question than keep it by failing to ask. And good teachers will take the same risks. They're willing to reveal their ignorance. The idea is to turn a classroom into a hospitable space for really safe exploration and debate. The idea is that both parties, students and teachers, contract with each other to make room for the mistakes of the other and to help make those mistakes scarcer and scarcer. Miss Manners says we can't correct every rude driver or shopper. We shouldn't try to correct loved ones all the time either, and certainly not if they are adults. A husband who at his wedding promises to honor his wife thereby promises not to try to correct her all the time, not to try to keep fixing her pronunciation or her grammar or the way she tells a story. Of course, he does have the look in certain social settings, but he will reserve this device for real emergencies and not put it on every time his spouse wrecks a punchline. And of course, the same goes for wives treating their husbands. If she is smarter than her husband, she doesn't think about that so much. Tenth, I would like to talk to us for just a minute about remembering people's names. Maybe we have left the ABCs now and have shaded into the middle of the alphabet, but in any case, this is a surprisingly sensitive matter, remembering people's names. And I guess one of the reasons that it is a surprisingly sensitive matter is that our names are extensions of ourselves. They are almost our alter ego. A spoken name is somebody's identity made audible, and so if a person uses our name to greet us, we feel hospitably treated. We are no longer a stranger and a sojourner, but a welcomed guest. On the other hand, if somebody forgets our name, we feel as if that person may have forgotten us. Now, what can we do about remembering people's names? Well, I'll offer four things. I'm in a list-making mood today. I'll offer four things. First, and absolutely first, God bless those people who greet you not only by saying your name, but also by saying theirs. "Hi, Carol," such a person might say. "I'm Sarah Johnstone, and we met at church 2 months ago." So now you have a context as well as a name. Blessed are the name givers, for they are hospitable people. Never, ever will I rebuke one of them by saying that, of course, I know perfectly well who they are. We never rebuke name givers. We imitate them. We say people's names a lot. Let this become an Epworth epidemic, spreading out from here across Michigan and then across America and then to the uttermost parts of the earth, everybody going around promiscuously giving out their names at the beginnings of conversations. Start a peaceful revolution. Second, if somebody forgets your name but makes a stab at it and gets it wrong, forgive that person on the spot. Do this in obedience to the golden rule, which says, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. Third, offer extra forgiveness to people who have to carry a lot of names in their memory or who are over 45 and therefore on life's downward slope. If the person you are talking to, fourth, doesn't remind you of his name and you can't come up with it, and now a third party is approaching that you're going to have to introduce this other person to, the only suggestion Miss Manners can come up with is from an anonymous Victorian who says, you look at the person whose name you're trying to recall in a friendly, co-conspiratorial way and then say, you don't happen to remember your name, do you? These are some ABCs of hospitality, of making room for others and of welcoming them there. And they seem so simple and so basic, and they are, but that's nothing against them. Acts of hospitality are acts of generosity, and acts of generosity are forms of love. And love is as good as virtue gets. Saint Teresa used to claim that salvation consists of loving union with God, and the way that you can tell whether you are united with God is by looking at your small daily duties of love. Translate. You tell how close you are to God by how you drive your car and what you do with your supermarket cart. The little acts form a practice. Practices become a habit. Habit works its way into our character, and with our character, we discover our own destiny. That's the way life goes. And when it goes this way, with the virtue of hospitality, people naturally start clearing space for others, especially for strangers. I'm talking now about people who make it their vocation to build shelters for the homeless, homes for the underhoused, people who build a house for some folks and then help them live there with skill and confidence, build a home for somebody, and then you turn a guest into a host who can now receive others in the home that you have helped to build. And think, of course, about people who welcome refugees, welcome immigrants, support international students, professors, people who think that if the country starts to look more like heaven, with people of every tribe and tongue and nation, that is nothing to resent and everything to welcome. The generous person makes room for others. According to the monks in Kathleen Norris's Spiritual Geography of the Dakotas, we measure growth in Christian faith by growth in hospitality, And the sign that we accept the strangeness and mystery of God is that we accept the strangeness and mystery of those who present themselves to us as images of God. Hospitable people. The great hospitals of Europe came from the diaconate of the Christian churches and from the hospices that were opened for pilgrims and travelers, and which eventually made room for the hurt and the people with disabilities, and then for the old and the orphaned and the impoverished. Among European Christians in the Middle Ages, this is where hospitals came from. And it's the history of hospices and hospitals that has generated the homes and shelters that Christians so much respect and support. And think today, for example, of people who take in foster children and treat them very well. Lots of society's heroes may be found among the strong and cheerful folks who open their homes to foster children or who adopt children deeply into their own homes and lives. Thinking about them, we may forget about some of the people that society fusses over, forget about Kim Kardashian and Bruce, now Caitlyn Jenner. These people are not heroes. They are mere celebrities. The real heroes are the generous people who welcome strangers, including the strangers that come to them as their own children. These are people with a sense of adventure and a sense of humor. Such adventurous folk expect to gain as much as they spend on this program. But even if they don't, it's okay with them. The reason is that they don't think of self-fulfillment as their goal. They don't think of life that way. To them, opening a space for others isn't a grim duty we perform while searching elsewhere for fulfillment. To them, self-expenditure is self-fulfillment. We grow by helping others grow. The truth is, in the Christian scheme of things, and by the way, over the years when I've been raising money for my institution and have met lots of business people, I've been so impressed with how thoughtful a philosophy of Christian business so many of them have, that they will flourish only by helping others to flourish, would be the most central way to put it, I guess. We human beings were created by God to spend ourselves. We thrive by helping others to thrive, and the reason is that we've been created in the image of God. Even at the center of the universe, life hums with the glad give and take of hospitality. John's gospel tells us that the Father is in the Son and the Son in the Father, that each loves and glorifies the other, that each divine person harbors two others at the center of his being. That's the inner life of God. That's where hospitality starts. It begins with the triune life of God and then spreads wonderfully to creatures. The act of creation itself fits the pattern. In creation, God expands the realm of being, making room for 100 to 150 billion galaxies, each galaxy comprising perhaps 100 billion stars, and most of the stars with their own orbital system. God generates all this galactic wealth, and inside it, one planet that we know. A planet inhabited not only by salamanders and sandhill cranes and fringed gentians, but also by human creatures who are living icons of God himself. In the incarnation, one of these creatures, the fierce and blessed Virgin Mary, opens herself to the God who comes as a stranger. Mary makes room in her heart and in her womb for this holy stranger and helps him to flourish there. God comes so often as a mysterious stranger, and not the least as the child of Mary. She probably ended up teaching Jesus how to pray. It may be that part of the prayer that he taught his disciples, he had first learned from his mother. The gospel of the Son of God is like the gospel of the law and prophets. It makes room for strangers and sojourners, for people with disabilities and people with a past. The New Testament gospel brings a lovely novelty. In Christ, there is now room for Gentiles and for slaves and for women. In the brave new world of Christ, people defer to each other, they welcome one another, they make room in their hearts for each other. In Trinity, creation, incarnation, and redemption, the seemingly small virtue of hospitality shows up as a first-class image of God. And that's why we want it. It's important to remember that the image of God in human beings is not just something we have, it's also something we do. It's something we put on or try out. We practice the image of God as if it were a role in the human drama. Imaging God is something we do. Practicing hospitality is one of its prime exhibits. No need to worry that this is going to go on all morning. I'm going to talk about 10 more minutes. But now, inevitably, a caution. Nobody can do it all where hospitality is concerned, and nobody should even try. We are finite creatures. We can't host everybody. Our space isn't big enough. Even a friendly person can handle only a limited number of close friends. And even a generous host or hostess can handle only a limited number of guests. God has room for the whole human race, but we are not God. Even in the most traditionally hospitable cultures, like the Bedouin culture, hosts expect guests to stay about 3 days. And they say so with their proverbs. Guests are like fish. After 3 days, they start to stink. Here's another one. When a stranger arrives, feed him for 2 days. On the third day, hand him a tool. Limits on our capacity. Some of them are matters of simple justice. If you're in line at a ticket window and somebody intentionally cuts into the line ahead of you, you don't owe that person that space. And maybe shouldn't offer it. According to Miss Manners, the thing to do on these occasions is to say in a firm voice, but friendly enough, "Excuse me, but the back of the line is over here." Say it loudly enough to make it the voice of the whole lined-up community. But don't do it in Texas, where people are now permitted to carry concealed handguns. Limits on hospitality. A marriage has room for two people. A rival might want to enter your marriage, but there's no room for him there, and somebody ought to say so very clearly. Another limiting thought. For us to be gracious in our homes does not mean that we have to give up all of our household rituals in the presence of guests. It doesn't mean, I will offer this as an opinion, it doesn't mean, for example, that we have to give up table prayers in the presence of non-Christians. In their homes, Christians pray at table, just as they should, and this includes praying in the name of Jesus Christ. That's the only way Christians know how to pray, and friendly guests understand. In our home, Kathleen and I, when we have non-Christians at table, say just a word before I pray and say, "It's our habit as Christians to pray before our meals. I hope you understand." And then I offer a prayer. In general, to be hospitable means to make space for others and to help them thrive in the space that you've made, but it doesn't mean that you accept everything that people think or do. A good classroom teacher receives students with unmistakable goodwill and respect, but doesn't welcome every statement or idea of a student. Of course not. How would anybody learn anything that way? Some ideas lead nowhere. Some statements are false, and good instructors ought to say so and do it very pleasantly. To paraphrase C.S. Lewis, a good instructor is like God, easy to please, hard to satisfy. Limits on our openness. To be multiculturally open does not, in my judgment, mean that you think every cultural practice is as good as every other cultural practice. It's no bigotry to reject the cultural practice of slavery or of clitoridectomy. Some people these days believe that in order to accept other persons, you have to accept everything these persons want to do, but I don't think that's so. Every parent knows that it's not so. We can distinguish between persons and the things that persons want to do, and we must. For example, I don't believe that we ought to simply absorb malicious gossip. The same goes for prying questions. If somebody asks, why aren't you married, or how much money did you earn last year, or why don't you have any children, if somebody asks these questions, I think we ought to answer the question with another. Why do you ask? Why does this matter to you? Or in severe cases, why would you ask so personal a question? We owe no hospitality to prying questions and ought to discourage them. We owe no hospitality to insults and ought to rebuke them. I think I've been blatantly insulted only about 3 times in my life. After the first time, the next 2 times, I said simply, "You've just insulted me." Just that. No more. I know that rebuking is a neglected craft these days. Very few churches have rebuke workshops. Maybe rebuking is a kind of surgery, a kind of delicate surgery that needs a clean and steady hand, and a lot of us don't feel up to it, but our dignity is non-negotiable. Even if we felt like surrendering it to the insults of others, we shouldn't do it for the simple reason that our human dignity has been conferred on us by God and is not ours to surrender. No hospitality for insults, or for treachery, or for cruelty, or for anything that corrupts human life. We welcome persons, but not everything that persons want to do or say. I'd like to close now by mentioning a kind of hero of hospitality that over the years I have thought a lot about and admired. If you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you will see lists of people from various nations that hid Jews during World War II. And I'm proud to say that of the nations of Europe and of the people celebrated by Jews for harboring them during World War II, one of the most prominent is the smallish nation of Holland, the Netherlands. And I know some people who harbored Jews during World War II. They're now getting very old, but they did it. And what's remarkable about them is how little they themselves make of it. They say, yes, we did it, or my parents did it. I was only a boy at the end of World War II, but my parents hid 2 Jews. And then they say, when you remark how great a risk that was and how brave, really risking your lives, because the Nazis not only slew Jews, they slew anybody who harbored them. They say it's only what anybody would have done. And it wasn't, but that's how they view it. Now, those are people who have this marvelous virtue so deep in their sinew and bone that it wouldn't have occurred to them not to do it. And when I think of them and think of hospitality, I think of them as heroes. Well, that's what I came to say, and now I've said it, so the wise thing is to keep still. I would encourage you, the next time you happen on Romans 12 or one of the pastoral epistles, and Paul says simply, practice hospitality, think of that pretty large. It's kind of a big deal. I would make a very cheerful placard or cardboard tent that says, this is a cell and tablet free zone, and put it on your table. And be very good natured and firm, both. You know, the fourth gospel says that Jesus came to us as of the one and only from the Father, full of grace and truth. That's a hard combination. But when you meet somebody who has it, who is very gracious and also really firm, it's impressive. I mean, we've all met people so full of grace that they can't bear to tell the truth to anybody lest they injure tender feelings. And also people full of truth right up to their hairline, but they're so graceless about it that you wish they wouldn't bother. Full of grace and truth. But he regarded their corruption as a religious emergency, and he needed to dent their self-deception.
Exactly. And that's
yeah.
The purpose. I should have said time, because that's not the right word, but it's very interesting.
There's in between John 7 and John 8, there's a free-floating story. It's not clear where it really belongs, but it's often placed there, about Jesus and a woman who had been caught in adultery. Now, some teachers of the law have brought this woman in front of Jesus, and you will notice or recall that they bring just the woman. So either she committed adultery all by herself, or else there's a double standard in play. And it's very interesting that Jesus, you know, says, let the first among you without any sin throw that first stone. And, of course, nobody does. And when everybody has left, Jesus says to the woman, I'm sure freely translating the Greek, don't keep on doing this. It's not, don't ever do this again, but don't keep on doing this. So truth for those judgmental teachers of the law, and grace and truth for the woman. Classic Jesus. Well, it feels like we've come to a natural conclusion. Thank you again for your kindness and hospitality yesterday and today. Love coming up here. And we'll drive home now with some very fine memories. God bless you.